Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Oh, I'm going to press it now, though. Just so I forget.
Now it's coming.
Yeah.
Recording on print.
That's got funny. I usually now have been pressing record right when I start, because a few weeks ago, now it's maybe been a month ago, I forgot to press record for one until we were like 30 minutes into the interview.
Oh my gosh.
I felt so bad. And so I usually try to press record right at the start, but I have not pressed it yet. So here we go. For the listener, I might as well just keep it going, because I love those just kind of casual conversations where we were going. But we were just talking about how much like ranchers specifically just work, and how it's, I don't know, it just doesn't make sense. I don't know. I shouldn't say it doesn't make sense. People do it and they enjoy it, but it's not something I want to do anymore, is just work all day, every day, the rest of my life. That's not, I enjoy what I do, but there is such a thing as too much of a good thing.
Yeah. Here's something that, where you're talking about something too much of a good thing. Yeah. I remember this one day, it was because I ranch on horseback, and that's what I love horses, and I love riding, and I love the things that you can do. And, they're just so versatile for handling livestock. Anyways, it was just one day I was thinking, oh man, I just want 2 days when I don't have to ride a horse.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh my gosh, Tom, you know how many people, if they heard you say that, they go, what are you talking about? I just dream about doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's too much of a good thing. Like, a lot of people say, if you do what you love, you don't need a vacation. I disagree with that. I forget who talks about sharpening the saw.
I'm not sure, but I know who you're. Yeah, I know the reference, I guess you're talking
about. Yeah, anyways, it doesn't matter. You still have to get away. And so you can think better, you get a better perspective.
Yeah.
And recharge.
Yeah. So, well, I guess this last winter, my wife and I went on vacation for the first time since our honeymoon, for like a legit vacation away for a week, and came back and I was like, I'm not waiting 4 years to do this again, or 5 years to do this again. It's not worth it. It was incredible and refreshing. And but I don't know. It, like you said, and I don't know, remember if it was before I pressed record or not, but like, there's this badge of honor with people that it's like, I haven't taken a day off in 4 years. I'm sorry.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. That sounds horrible.
Well, like you were saying, before you hit record, you're working 14-hour days right now, and it's not fun. Yeah. You may enjoy what you're doing, but putting that much time in every day is not fun. You need to regroup, and you need some downtime. You need some time to think. Yeah. And funny thing is, after people have read the book, and they contact me, and not one of them has asked me about what we were just talking about what how to reduce your labor. And the title of the book, Ranching Like a 12-year-old, and it's just asking that simple question. Can a 12-year-old do this? What people ask me about is my grazing.
Yeah.
And the grazing in the sweet spot. All the questions are about that.
Yeah.
Not a single one have I had about, okay, well, how do you do this? How do you get your labor down?
Yeah. When you wrote the book, did you think about it being as like being a grazing book, or was the intention to be more of like a making a lifestyle, making a business? What's the kind of subtitle is mostly making ranching easy, simple, and fun, something like that?
That's correct. Yeah.
Very little to do with actual making your soil more productive, your grass more productive. I mean, it's about lifestyle is what the intention of the book largely seems to be.
I would think so. The title, most certainly.
Yeah.
I'm very passionate about growing grass.
No doubt, no doubt. Yeah.
And I don't know. Once I took holistic management in 2000, and then from there, and then I read right after that, I went out and bought Andre Wilson's book, Grass Productivity, and I devoured that, and it just like, oh my gosh, and I just got hooked on that, and that's a huge passion of mine. You know what? It was just the intention of the book was to put my thoughts down, and my ideas, and it wasn't really to drum up a following or anything like that. It was just to put my ideas down,
Yeah.
and I enjoy it, and I enjoy the grass management, and I'm always looking at ways to improve what I do.
Yeah. Well, that's cool, 'cause that's what I try to do with this podcast, and that's what we're going to do today, is get a little bit about who you are and your stuff for people who are listening here wondering, who is Jared even talking to? I haven't introduced you. Maybe introduce yourself, Tom. Talk a little bit about who you are, what you do, and I want to dive into your story. I want to hear, I think you said you started in around 2000, and your book, from what I've read so far, I haven't completed it yet, has a ton of wisdom in it. And so a 20-year history with all of what you've learned, that's a pretty impressive career. So yeah, introduce yourself. Tell me, I guess, who you are and what you're doing.
Okay, well, my name's Tom Kravitz. I know it's not, my name isn't spelt the way that it sounds, but
I was
yeah,
wondering, yeah.
my grandfather came to Canada in 1927 from Poland, and that's just the way it's pronounced in
Sure.
Polish. So, yeah, I started grass farming, I guess, in 2000. I actually came from the oil patch. I grew up in the oil patch,
Okay.
but I had many relatives that were farmers, and I just loved that. I was never a motorhead. I didn't like driving trucks. My parents had a trucking company, but I just did it because that's what I grew up in. But my dream was always to farm. So started that. Took holistic management in 2000, and then just jumped in.
Yeah.
And we marketed meat, direct marketed meat for about I guess 7 years. Hogs, sheep, turkeys, layer hens, and beef. And it's just grown from there. And I just somehow, for some reason, I developed this passion for growing grass. I dream about it. That's how
Awesome.
passionate I became about it. Yeah, and then the title of the book is Ranching Like a 12-Year-Old. And a friend of mine, his one daughter and I were good buddies. And one summer, her and her friend came, Heather and Tiffany. And so Heather was 11 and Tiffany was 12 that summer. And then they ended up coming till they were 16 and 17. And we had a blast together. They were crazy, and they were game for anything. And it was by the second year I realized for them to be really helpful and do the things that they wanted to do, because they were really engaged, I had to set everything up so that they could do it. And what happened there was that developed this template so a 12-year-old could do it. And then we had more time to have just enjoy things. Enjoy, we weren't rushed all the time. We could take our time and enjoy the farming and ranching. I'm not sure how far you are into the book, but anyways, I developed this template with the idea of can a 12-year-old do this? And then the next thing I knew, it was just things were very easy. And using that template, I got up to the point where we were running 3,000 yearlings in the summer, and I had one or two summer students, and between the two of us, we had 6 hours of work a day. So it's kind of embarrassing to say, particularly for people who have that badge of honor of working hard. We wouldn't start till about 10 in the morning, and then we were done. Both of us, we were back at the yard, about 4:30, and that's after having an hour and a half lunch break.
Wow.
Yeah, and then what was cool where I lived around Athabasca, there was a number of semi-retired farmers, and they didn't do much, and they had all this time, and they loved to play poker. So we're playing poker like at night, like, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. And it was a blast. And the summer students had a blast too, because some of them had never played poker before. And then they're sitting around, and these guys, you know, these old Polish and Ukrainian guys, they're a hoot, you know, because they don't care anymore. They're old and they've been there and they've done it. And it was just a lot of fun.
That's awesome. That's the best. That's where, like, so I mentioned earlier that, you know, we have these times where we're working like crazy hard and stuff. Right now, we just had a newborn, and we're also in kind of our slower season where life has slowed down, and we're having time to do things like that. And it's just the best, because it's like, yeah, you love it a whole lot more when you're not doing it all the time, and you can split it up with all the fun stuff in between. I miss actually, it's actually too bad, because I also like playing poker with my buddies, but unfortunately they're all really busy and we haven't been able to play in quite a while. So I'll have to make a trip up there and play cards with you.
Yeah, you bet.
That's awesome, man. Well, I love just that idea of ranching like a 12-year-old, making it simple, because there's no reason that we have to complicate things just because we get older, right? Yet for why can't we? Why do we have to make things so complicated, especially when you've shown and proven that there are ways to do it without making it complicated?
Well, you know, to give you an example, so this one friend of mine, actually, I can say his name because he's deaf, Jim Bazzilo. So his wife passed, I forget how many years ago, and then he needed a break, and we ended up renting his land for 3 years, and I just sent the template up, you know, because like I said, it was just a cookie cutter template, and we just put the fences in the alleys, and we had the water, and it was just done, and we ran that. Rented that for 3 years. I didn't really actually realize that he was going to come back and start ranching. I thought he was kind of done. But so now, so Jim would be, but he must be 78. Yeah, he's 78 or 79 now. He is running more cows and having more fun than he did when he was in his 40s and he only had 60 cows. So he's running about 120 to 150 mother cows right now. His daughter lives in Bahrain, and she has a condo in Panama, and Jim buggers off for the winter. He has his paddock set up. He does bale grazing. He has his paddock set up, so he puts enough feed in for a week in each paddock, and he gets his grandkids to come and open up a gate. And he's been doing that for I don't know how many years.
So, yeah, you made it so good he couldn't resist getting back into the business. If you had
I
just
know,
shown
the
him,
dirty
what you should have
bugger.
done is when he comes out to take a look, is just be like, every time, man, this is tough. You know, I appreciate you giving me this opportunity, but I'm just not sure I can do this anymore. And then when he leaves, that's when you just open up the fence and go home. But yeah,
Yeah,
no.
no, I remember. Yeah, anyways, that's,
That's
you
awesome.
know, like I said, I think I talk about it in the book. The title was actually going to be, I wasn't sure if it was ranching like an 80-year-old or ranching like a 12-year-old. You know, because if a 12-year-old can do, if you have things set up for a 12-year-old, then an 80-year-old can do it, and you can keep on going. You know, certainly, you know, you might need some help, you know, for doing this or that, like day work stuff. But the day-to-day stuff, if you set it up easy, you know, anyone can do it.
So I'm sure we can't get into it in the depth that you do in the book, but can you talk about this template? What is the template? What are you doing on this place to make things kind of so simple?
You just have to cut down the day-to-day work. And so it, you know, you ask everything you do, you ask yourself the question, can a 12-year-old do this? So if you're having to drag around a water trough and water line, a 12-year-old cannot do that. And if they do do it, they're not going to be happy about it. Like as an example, I really like alleys. I did not start out that way. But then once I factored in the amount of labor involved of moving water trough, well, moving that stuff. I remember when I took holistic management, our instructors and their friends, they had this competition on who had the rattiest, the oldest water truck that they drove around from pasture to pasture. And so, like, I really drank the Kool-Aid. when I took holistic management. So, I built this flat this tank on a flat deck, and so we're driving that around property, and I quickly realized how much labor was involved and how precarious it was. If something, your tank, your float leaked or something. And so we went from there to pumping water to the pipeline, and
Yeah.
we installed the pipeline. And then I know I didn't have alleys to start with, so we're just moving a small water trough around. But even that, that just became cumbersome.
Yeah.
And so now I've gone to alleys. I have a video on how I build fence, electric fence. That's part of the template there. I know it's not the cheapest. And I tell you what, when we first started, we were building 2 acre paddocks every 2 days with polywire and rebar, and we were
Yeah.
pounding rebar in.
Rebar. I
And
read that and I thought that was just wild. I mean, there's just about they were cheap, I'm sure, but that's wild carrying around, lugging around those rebar posts.
well, you know what? This is how your mind gets working. So here, this is okay. Well, we need to be cheap,
Yeah.
okay? So then, well, it was a pain pulling these posts around, and so I tried it with the horse, pulling the horse, and we didn't have very good, well-trained horses at that time, and had some adventures there. And then so we're dragging this toboggan around, and then I, you know, my the light bulb went on. Oh, a golf cart, one of those pull type golf carts.
Yeah.
So I went and bought two of those at a yard sale and rigged that up. And I just thought, oh, this is so good. But I was missing the point. I
Yeah.
was missing the stumbling block, and that was labor when I should just stop doing it. So have you got to the point where I talk about, ask yourself the question, can a 12-year-old do this? And if a 12-year-old cannot,
Yeah.
you stop doing, or you change it so they can, or you stop doing it.
Yeah. Well, so my question on this, I guess, is something that a lot of people talk about is like maximum adaptability. I mean, you probably heard now, like that's what is kind of the thing of grazing, the new term. There's all the different terms, but the adaptive is the new one. And you want to have maximum adaptability, water points you can move anywhere, fences you can build in any direction. You can, weave around the weed patch so you can get high stock density and stuff like that. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, because when you go for maximum adaptability, that means you have to do more work. You're giving up permanence for adaptability, and permanence
You
is
bet.
what reduces labor. Adaptability requires labor. What are your thoughts on that, I guess?
I think you just answered
Yeah.
it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
And I just realized to be scalable, you have to cut down your labor. Like honest, and I'm not exaggerating. With the template that I developed, we're running 3,000 yearlings.
Wow.
And
Yeah.
two for two people, a total of 6 hours of work a day.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm not exaggerating.
No, that's incredible. Yeah. And do you feel you've given up? Well, maybe this is a maybe we'll I want to talk more about the book and we'll get more into some of that and stuff too, but I want to hear your story. I mean, you're going to share a lot of what you would share in the book. The book is your story and the things you've learned. So let's talk more about your story, I guess, and how you kind of learned these things. I guess starting out, you talked about rebar. You went with rebar and you're moving all these fences all the time. You had water that you were pulling around and stuff like that, in a water truck or whatever. What were the I guess talk about your mindset at that time. Were you enjoying it? How much were you working? And what were the early things that maybe started to get you to realize you needed to change? What were some of the early changes and the adaptations throughout your time to kind of get to where you figured out now what is the template that you use today?
Well, I already told you went to holistic management,
Yes.
and a big thing that we were taught was cut your costs. So that's why the rebar
Yeah, sure.
came about, and that's why we just had the temporary fencing, because it was cheap. But the fact labor was not factored in there. And that was, labor is a big thing. There's two things with labor. One is, so if you're hiring labor, you know exactly how much that is going to cost. But if you're doing the labor yourself, a lot of times that cost is hidden. But there's another cost of labor that we don't factor in, and that's our mental capacity. So if you're working the 14-hour days and you crawl in bed and you're just exhausted, physically exhausted, you don't have time to think well, anyways.
I completely understand. No, I especially over the last few years, I've been working. Long story short, I've been work. I took an off farm job for a couple of years, and so I was working an off farm job plus the farm job plus our meat business plus my podcast plus our real estate stuff. And it's like you get so much going on. Mental capacity is a huge thing, and things fall through the cracks. That's what I really. And you just don't do as good of a job. And so you maybe even think by working so hard, you're doing the best job possible, but you probably end up missing out on little things that require that working on the business versus working in the business, you miss out on little things that can make the huge changes, all for the in the name of work.
So I was riding around. I had no, we had no employees. It was just us. And I think we were at that time, we were at about 1,200 head, 1,200 mother cows that we were custom grazing. And so, and had no employees. And I could see that there was this land available. These old guys, they're retiring. And I knew that land was available, but I was exhausted. And I just like, oh, I should go and have a coffee with them, after, tonight. And okay, I'm gonna do it. And then I get off my horse at, like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and just like, oh, I'm too tired. And then I read Kiyosaki's book, Cash Flow Quadrant, and the light went on for me. And I remember the day. So I'd finished the book, and I'm riding around on my horse, and I knew that there was a big chunk of land that I knew was available. And I was exhausted, and I thought, Tom, you just have to bite the bullet and hire a summer student. I don't have to have a full-time employee, because the stuff in the winter, at that time I was only keeping, I was bale grazing and swath grazing. So that's like, we had 550 or 700 cows kept over the winter. Well, that's like barely a part-time job when you're bale grazing or swath grazing. And yeah, and I just realized I can just hire a summer student. And the light went on. And boy, once we hired first summer student, in no time at all, I want to say in 5 years, got to 3,000 head in the summer.
Well, I think that's where we're at right now. And it's not even so much like this, like you're tired at the end of the day, but it's like, so at the way you were working at that point, if you went and you talked to them and they said, yes, I'll lease you that farm, how are you going to do it? You don't have any
Not.
more time.
That's
It's not,
right.
that's where we're at now. Or it seems like sometimes it's like, how do we, this business maybe isn't big enough for multiple families, so we have to get bigger. We have to scale this somehow, but we can't handle anymore. We don't have any more time. So, in order to
Well,
scale a business, you have to
right. It
figure it out.
has to be scalable first, and that's one thing. I already had the template, so the tent, it was scalable. So every property that I went to rent, I figured out you got to figure out the water first. That's the first thing, and then you figure out your fencing, after that, and that's the template. And yeah, that first year is a lot of work, and you're gonna have to put in those long hours, but you just get it done. And then after that, it's like, okay, now we have time, and then we can go and look for the next property.
Well, after that one, I'm just curious, after that one experience where after 2 years the landlord wanted the land back, do you put in long-term leases now? Is that a requirement if you're going to go and invest in all the infrastructure and to build out this template that you have a long-term lease on a place?
It was actually after 3 years, but I'm actually not custom grazing anymore. I've moved into ranch management. But it's the what I did was in my leases, I put in 5 years.
Okay.
So when it's custom grazing, I put in 5 years. And if the lease was terminated, I got all my fencing material back, and I just pulled the fences
Yeah.
and all my water line, and I just
Sure.
pulled it.
Good.
But after 5 years, I knew that the fencing was already paid for.
That
You know,
makes sense.
because have you watched any of my videos
I didn't know you
on
did
my?
videos.
Oh yeah, I have like I don't know, probably 7 or 8 on the YouTube channel. And yeah, so the QR code for the different chapters,
Yeah.
that takes you right to the video, the
Cool.
corresponding video for that chapter.
Sure.
Yeah, so I have my fencing video in there, and again, it's like it's not the least expensive, but it accounts for labor.
Yeah.
So if you know, one thing that I found was moose and elk were taking out my fences, and so in the spring, you know, spring is busy, and a lot of times, like I don't know, you're a lot drier than where you are, but in the spring, a lot of times what happens is we go from winter to summer. Spring in the last, I don't know how many years, it's just been like overnight. So you don't have time to go and do repairs in the spring. And a lot of times it's too muddy, you know,
Yeah.
because it's just a nightmare. So
Yeah.
you don't have time to do repairs. So that's a factor that I took into account when I was developing my template. You know, that's why I use the end post that I do. That's why I use the line post that I do. There may be better things, and I know that there probably are. And basically what I'm doing in the video is I'm just showing, demonstrating that's this is what I do.
Yeah.
And I'm always on the lookout for doing things better,
Yeah.
you know, more efficient, less expensive. But that's just what I do, and that's the template that I have.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And people should definitely check out the book. Like I said, I have not finished it. It's my first book to finish reading in winter. Every time I get some free time, I'm sitting on the couch and reading it. But winter is when I get most of my reading done. So, but check that out. But I do want to like talk a little bit more about your story, I guess, because I think that's where, I don't know, I just think everybody has a cool story, and the fact that you started in 2000 and 23 years were running 3,000, yearlings and all this stuff. I mean, you scaled a business, and you talked about how you've done a lot of things in there. You did direct marketing and custom grazing and all these things. So I want to talk a little bit more about your ranch history. And in early 2000, when you decided that you wanted to get into the business of ranching, not having any experience or maybe, I don't know what experience, it sounds like you had some family involved, but how did you get started? How did you go out, seek land? What were some of the first things you decided to try and invest in, I guess, as far as infrastructure? I mean, share your startup story. Those are the inspiring pieces. Those are inspiring to me.
Okay, well, this, you know what, honestly, the story is, it's not anything remarkable. It just everybody has does the same thing. You get on a journey and you just go. But
Yeah.
the it was my dream ever since I was 12 years old. And you know, coming from the oil patch, I didn't think that it was possible, but I fell in love with a gal that I knew pretty much my whole life, who lived just 2 miles from my grandparents. And then you know, it kind of just went on from there. And her parents had 373 acres that they had rented out. They weren't farmers.
Sure.
And at that time, I still thought that anybody can do this. And I think that's a big prevailing attitude, that anybody can do this. And I was just overly confident in my abilities, and I was too stubborn to fail. So I just kept going, and you know, I met some great people. Like I met this through holistic management. Met my friend Glenda, who ranched herself, and she really helped me continue on the path of grazing hogs outside, and actually finishing hogs on forage alone. And
Really?
she, yeah. And actually, you know what? I hated hogs because all I saw them was in a dirty pen, and I didn't even eat pork because it just all I could smell was the hog barn.
Yeah.
And now I actually love pasture raised pork, and I love hogs are my favorite animal to graze. And if I had a market, I would have like 1,000 hogs,
wow.
And I would be grazing them just like I graze cattle and sheep.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I know there are people out there who do it almost entirely on forage and stuff, and I've never understood that. So that's actually maybe something I will ask is, how did you do pasture fully finished? Did you say like fully forage developed, like no grain?
Yeah. Up after 150 pounds.
Wow.
And this is, I don't know anybody who's doing that.
Yeah, me either.
Like, actually, I just went to, okay, I'm going to ramble a little bit. I'm just going to jump into a little story that just happened. So so you understand the grazing in the sweet spot?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But so you've not read, everybody you've does, read that so part. Maybe explain that, because we're
well, I'm not going to explain that right now. Okay. We'll get into it. But so anyways, there's this guy, Jonathan, I think his last name is Elliot, and his farm is living, I'm terrible at names. I'm so embarrassed, Jonathan, no if you're listening to, well, I know he listens to your podcast. he's out in Virginia, not too far from Washington, D.C. Anyways, he reached out to me and he just, he said, oh, I think this is the missing key for my grazing. Because, you know, I've been doing this, the grazing and non-selective grazing, but I'm not having, the end result is not what I'm looking for. And he says, this is the key. And I just, I'm not into developing a following, so I'm pretty reluctant. I've been asked to be a mentor to a few people, and that's not what I want to do with my life. But he's already, Jonathan's already had lots of grazing experience. And I thought, I wonder, I should just follow him, see if he would be game for me to follow his progression. Cause he drank my Kool-Aid. Yeah. So he's going, he's going to try it. And yeah, and he was very receptive. And so, I end up flying there and just for a day to have a little, visit with him and see his pastures. And yeah, and he raises hogs as well. And I was telling him about this, you know, finishing hogs after 150 pounds. And he doesn't know anybody who is doing that either. But the thing with Glenda, she built this cool device. So she had her self feeder. Mm-hmm. And again, Glenda ranched by herself.
Okay.
So she had to make things simple.
Yeah.
So she had the self feeder, and she just had panels around the self feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And then she built this one panel, and she put the spacings such that about 150 pounds, the hogs couldn't get in there anymore.
Sure.
So they weaned themselves off the self feeder.
Huh.
And what I have found is that after, I don't know, I haven't done tons of hogs, but probably I have finished maybe close, all told, maybe 800 hogs.
Wow. Okay.
That way.
That's plenty.
All told. Well, I'm not able to raise hogs every year, you know, because like now I'm, I've been ranch managing for the last 7 years or so, and not every place has hogs.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyways, what I have found was that as long as they have high legume pastures, I can finish them in 6.5 to 7 months. And when I say finish, it's just like 225 to 250 pounds.
Sure.
So in that period of time. Yeah. Now, if you do not have the legume and you just have grass, forget it.
Okay.
Like it's going to take forever to get to that weight. But boy, once they get on the high legume pasture, they go crazy.
What is there certain breeds that you need for that?
I never did that. Okay. And I knew listening to your podcast, you were going to ask that very question because you talk lots about genetics.
Yeah.
And my thinking, the first thing that we need to do is get our pastures in order and get our grazing in order before we start looking for genetics.
Sure.
With hogs, you do need good genetics. But all I did was I bought wiener pigs from a guy that he had a barn, and he was an excellent hog man. And those hogs just grew like crazy, you know. And, you know, because when they're starting, you know, I'd get them, you know, 40 to 60 pounds as wiener pigs.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't take very long and they're onto the forage, mm-hmm. you know, because they're getting grain at that time as well.
Yeah.
So it's not like they just, you know, you cut off the grain and they're, they grow very well.
Yeah.
And I remember like in the, and then that when we farrowed, well, those, I picked out gilts that did well on forage mm-hmm. and those babies did very well.
Yeah. That's something I didn't know was possible. They're not the ruminant stomach, so I didn't think that they could do that, but that's pretty incredible that you managed to have success with that. And so that was obviously then part of your direct marketing journey, I imagine, was the pastured pork, because you're not going to go and sell those just as regular finished hogs on a commodity market like anything else. When you got started with the farming and agriculture, did you jump right into direct marketing then right off the bat?
Yep. Yeah, yep, yeah. We did. No fear.
Yeah.
And I, yes, I have a saying, God hates a coward. So, and I ain't no coward.
Yeah,
so
funny.
Yeah, but, sorry. I know I rambled just a second, but let's get back to your initial question about the journey. So, you know, I was doing, like I said, I drank the Kool-Aid from holistic management mm-hmm. and I got a lot from there.
Yeah.
But I did not get the results. And, you know, I had my oil patch money that I had saved up and it was pretty much gone in 3 years.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, I had the money. So, and I believe this, and then I shouldn't say it was all gone, but I did have a lot left from what I started.
Sure.
And then I heard about Ranching for Profit. And that was a big turning point mm-hmm. For me. And so I took Ranch for Profit, then took it again, and then I joined the EL. And you've taken Ranch for Profit, I think you just spoke about it. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. But you haven't joined the EL program?
Have not. No.
Okay. And I'm not getting a kickback from Dallas about this, but the EL program, I think it was in it for 3 years. It's just a fantastic program. You know, you really hold your feet to the fire. And not only that, it helps you get things accomplished to where you want to go. Because, sure. you know, we need help yeah. and we need support and we need people holding us accountable. Oh, just before we leave this about the hogs, I just remembered. So Jonathan, like I said, they raise hogs. And yeah, so we direct marketed pork for about 7 years. And I went through tried out about, I don't know, probably 12 different abattoirs.
Mm-hmm.
Was never happy with the bacon.
Yeah.
And Jonathan's bacon, they cooked me breakfast. Best bacon I have ever had in my life. Yeah. Wow. From their little, and his abattoir is 20 minutes away from his house.
Yeah. Well, I bet if you did 12, you had to be driving quite a ways to get some of those, because to find even three within an hour is pretty lucky for a lot of folks. That's awesome. Okay. So you started off with direct marketing and you direct marketed meats off your place. Tell me why you decided to go the direct marketing route and not the commodity marketing route.
Well, we took Ranching for Profit, Holistic Management in January. And then in February or March, we took a marketing course, direct marketing course through sure. Alberta Ag. And just like, you know, it was this all rainbows and roses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's yeah. where we just, you know, and I thought, okay, well, that's what we need to do. And so that's how we started the direct marketing.
Yeah.
Sure. And then we just grew it. But the problem is, and I really enjoyed the direct marketing. I enjoyed the connection with the people. I enjoyed developing different products. The problem was we stalled out in volume. You know, well, you know, ranch profit. You have one of the keys to profit is turnover. You know, we had a fantastic gross margin per unit, but we were selling. We topped out at 45 hogs and about 50 lambs. You know, and about 150 turkeys. You can't raise a young family and pay mortgage and all that stuff on selling 45 hogs. It doesn't matter, even if your gross margin was $1,000 a hog.
Well, I think that's I'm glad you shared that, because you said they talked all, you know, rosy how great it was and everything like that. And it almost always, and actually the person I just talked to before you, the podcast I recorded just before you here, is a direct marketer who's found a ton of success down in Indiana, and he's marketing a bunch. And it sounds fantastic when you hear of these people who have built these markets, but I guess we probably all underestimate how difficult it is to build a market like that, especially in a non-urban area, if you're a ways from a market, you know, population center of any sort. And so it can be pretty challenging, and there's a ton of labor and work that goes into it, that if you're not able to scale and spread that labor over more customers and more sales, it's a very high overhead. Your gross margin can be great, but when your overhead is all this labor and time, for a very low return, that's a challenge.
Yeah. You know, so like Jonathan, I just remembered his farm name is Living Pastures Farm. Yeah. And I don't know the town that anyway, they have this gorgeous farm store on one of the properties that he rents. Yeah. And it's just gorgeous, and he's just set up, and I wished I had that.
Yeah.
You know, because it's fantastic. And then, but they're in an urban setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, he has different challenges. You know, like, yeah. I was talking about, you know, walking your cattle down the road. Well, you cannot do that. Like, it's too much traffic. And there's too many, you know, these acreages, there's just too many acreages. It's an urban setting in a country. Yeah. Whereas, you know, we were, you know, I was able to put cells together and just walk cattle, you know, the big herd 4 miles down the county road.
Yeah.
You know, so go ahead.
It's kind of an analysis then of your context, in that it's set up to scale. And so, you know, when you can scale, that's kind of what a commodity business is. It's a business of scale, versus a direct marketing business is really not a scale business. You can scale it, but he had that context of his environment that he can access people. You didn't, you had an environment where you could easily scale, totally. Then it made maybe sense to shift, pivot direction towards a commodity based business of some sort.
Yeah. And that was like, it was a tough, for me, it was a tough decision to make, because I really enjoyed the direct marketing, but the amount of time that it took to do the, you know, just the marketing part. And I knew that I had the template already built for custom grazing. And I knew that I could scale that very quickly, which we did.
Yeah. And I wonder if one of the hardest parts of shifting and pivoting is maybe admitting that what you were doing didn't work. And I feel like for a lot of people, myself included, it's our pride. It's hard to admit maybe that what we're doing doesn't
work. Totally.
Yeah.
But, well, you know what? Let's continue on that road about how I discovered this sweet spot. So I had amazing results following the prescription from what Andre Voisin, you know, talked about in his book, and what I learned from holistic management. And I was getting amazing results. But really, I think it was about year five, I started to get this inkling that I was not really improving the soil. Sure. All I was doing was I just got organized. I got my grazing under control. And which is a pretty big feat too, you know, like, you know, increase, maybe not increase production, but increase utilization 3 to 4-fold
Sure.
from when I started, you know, in a short period of time. But yeah, I wasn't improving the soil. And that was a big blow to my ego, because I knew what my results were. I was writing. At that time, I was writing about it, you know, and do this, do this. And, you know, I was doing talks and stuff. And I forget what it would have been, definitely year eight, 7 or 8 into the journey. I said, okay, I'm not getting the results that I thought I should be getting, and that I'm saying that you will get. So I stopped writing. I stopped doing any talking, and I just stayed at home. I didn't even do any more reading, because I got to, what's the word? I disillusioned, sure, because I'm hearing these people say that about all these results. And so I'm following that, you know, what I was told. And then I knew they weren't getting the results either.
Yeah.
And I just stayed on the ranch and I figured it out. And yeah, then I stumbled on this grazing in the sweet spot. That was another humbling experience when I had that. Was I had one of our customers, our biggest customers, they sent us I think they must have sent us probably 1,400 head from the one feedlot. And I go in there, you know, after took all the animals, or sent all the animals home, and go down to the feedlot office. And he told me, I need to do better. I need to get better gains.
Really?
And okay, because that was another thing. I kind of knew that I should be getting better gains. You know, I was doing maybe 1.5 to 1.7, but he wanted better.
Okay.
And okay, now I have to figure that out.
Yeah. Carry on then. What did figuring it out mean? And it's interesting. 1.5 to 1.7 isn't that bad, I guess, for a grazing over a whole season. And maybe clarify a bit before. What were you doing at that point that you thought was right but wasn't making you soil health gains?
I was grazing too early in phase two.
Okay.
So, you know, when you went to the ranch for profit, you had that grass growth curve.
Maturity curve or whatever, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So in holistic management, you know, we were taught you want to stay in, at that time anyways, I think it's maybe has changed now, but you want to stay in that phase two. You want to keep the grass in phase two. So that's what I was doing. And I was doing a good job at it, but I was early phase two. So then the animal performance suffered.
Too washy, too high.
Washy. Yep.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of what I noticed was by the time that I got into August, really. Yeah, that second week in August, then I started the animals really gaining weight. Like even our horses, like they just started getting fat. And at that time, okay. So, you know, the nutrient density is getting better. And then somehow I actually don't remember exactly, but I just ended up shifting that to later phase two, just before the sward goes into reproductive phase, and that's the sweet spot. And then what happened was I was getting much better gains on the animals, and I was still getting all this benefit to increase grass production.
Yeah. Well, and I've even heard, I've been on farm field days where people talk about rotational grazing, specifically a dairy was this farm that I'm thinking of, where they talk about how they've been doing this grazing management for decades. This ground was in pasture and they're just not seeing the benefits that you're talking of. And what's like notorious for a lot of grazing dairies that I've seen anyway, and I think I know people are getting better at it and stuff too, is grazing very early maturing, very early maturity grass, really washy stuff. And I mean, plants need to be able to put up leaves and actually grow to a stage where they have deep roots and are pumping carbon into the soil to build soil health. And if you continue to grow it and clip it off before it ever gets to that later, you're never going to have that soil health benefit that you started to experience once you've let that plant get just a little more mature.
Yeah, exactly. And I know there's a big following for non-selective grazing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple things there. Like I know I've you know, people have said that what I'm doing, you know, that probably won't work.
Yeah.
And but and there's no research to back me up, which I've been trying to get a few researchers to do the research, and they haven't, particularly Chris Nichols, because she's Dr. Chris Nichols.
Yep.
I don't know if you've heard of her. Okay.
Yep, for sure.
You know, I've had numerous discussions about this grazing in the sweet spot with her, and she really supports this, but she's so busy in demand on doing other things, you know, with this carbon sequestration thing that we're on right now. She doesn't have time to do it, and she, you know, who's going to fund it, right?
Yeah.
But there's lots of research pointing in that direction, that when plants are just before flowering, that's when plants release the highest concentration of root exudates. And not only that, there's research that has documented that is the time when the root exudates are the highest nutritional quality. And then once the plant goes into the reproductive phase, the plant stops releasing these root exudates, and those exudates are going into the production of the seed.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was actually this grazing thing. As I was reading it, I was like, this is the first time I've heard this perspective, and you shared data that backed it up and stuff, talking about this grazing and timing the rest windows or rest periods. I don't remember what term you use exactly, but like, what's your rest period and why you won't go longer than you don't want a long, or you don't want any forage to get into that extended maturity, the phase three or whatever grass and stuff.
Oh, that's actually, that's not quite right. Cause we're looking at at the sward. Okay. Mm-hmm. So your paddock. And so kind of now what I see is, there's about 15 to 20% of plants that end up going into reproductive phase.
Yeah.
And that's, I find that is for the balance of the whole sort. That is about that's just about right.
Yeah.
But I use the cowpats as, indicator to tell me if I'm in the right spot. And have you got to that section where I talk about, you know, there's, well, now I call it the Goldilocks cowpat.
Okay.
Not too soft, not too soft, not too hard, just right.
Just right. Yeah. That's
yeah. Funny. So the just right cowpat is about 2.5 inches high. Yeah. And if most of your cowpats are that at that height, then you're just right.
Yeah. And I thought you had talked about at some point though, like if you let it get too mature, or you extend the rest period too long, that you have reduced forage on the regrowth. You have reduced production the rest of the year. And that was like a really eye-opening.
At least 50% in my experience. And the way that I found that was by luck. And that was because I was using my eye, and you know, I had all this forage left over, and they got to stay there, you know, take it down to, you know, 50% or whatever.
Yeah.
And once you do that, you're screwed for the rest of the year, and you never get caught up, because you cannot get back to the sweet spot. And those plants have done their job. Once they get to maturity and to the reproductive phase, they have done their job for the year. And so they can just coast after that.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting, because I think you mentioned some people say you can't do things, and you probably have gotten some flack from some things like that, because there are folks out there who talk about maximum rest periods, giving them 40, 60, 70, 90 day full year rest periods and or something like that. And based on what you've seen, you're giving up a ton of production potential when you go for that. There may be some benefits, but you are giving up production potential, and also you're giving up some photosynthesis. Like you said, that plant's reached maturity. It's no longer photosynthesizing and sequestering and pumping carbon through the root exudates at the rate that it would be if it was in a vegetative or phase two.
You bet, Jared. Like, and there's a pile of research that talks about the, well, maybe I shouldn't say a pile, but there's numerous papers that I've read that talk about, you need to keep the plant vegetative so that the roots keep growing. You know, this was documented all the way. I think the first paper, the earliest paper that I read was 1955. Yeah, 1955. And he talked about how the less severe the defoliation, the plant, the roots keep growing. And yeah, I read this one document from the Nebraska Natural Resources. Yeah, Nebraska Natural Resources. And they described that if you only take 10 to 40% of the plant, the root keeps extending. Chris Nichols, Dr. Chris Nichols, she talks about, if you only feed the biology once a year, which is what happens when, the plant gets defoliated, then that's when compensatory photosynthesis kicks in and you get this huge flush of root exudates going to the soil biology. Well, that's all great. So the biology comes alive and, yeah, let's do our thing. And they're all excited. Well, then they don't get any more food. So they go back
Yeah,
to dormant.
sure.
And what's that scientist from New Zealand? Oh, Nicole Masters. Yeah. I've read some of her stuff talking about, in her opinion, in North America, most of our rangelands, the soil biology is dormant. It's asleep. In my mind, I want to keep that biology awake. And so that's why, I always thought about it as pulsing the roots. And now the more research that I have read, that's pretty much basically what I was doing, was I was just keeping that those exudates flushing in there and keeping those roots growing.
Well, I think that was well described, and when I read that was one of my takeaways so far, it was that was an interesting, a well-described explanation for why to not let it get too mature. And I think that we see that a lot in CRP in the United States. I don't know if Canada has something similar. It's Conservation Reserve Program, where essentially the government pays to put land into forage and let it sit idle for 15 years and stuff. And it's, we bought a farm that was in CRP for 15 years and it was biologically dead soil. The idea, of putting ground into forage is that it would be better, but the grass would just grow, get mature, smother out everything beneath it, so nothing else can grow and photosynthesize, and there's nothing feeding the biology, and there's no biology cycling nutrients, and there's no nutrients growing more forage. And when we took over that farm, it was biologically dead. And the opposite effect of what a conservation reserve program one would think that they should be intending to do. And I think that's similar to what we can do when we let things overrest, perhaps. And I want to take more data on what, because we do, especially like on a year this year, we're very dry and we've let grass get more mature than we otherwise may have. A lot of times when we have extra forage, we'll make some hay and move that into the rotation on the next rotation through. But we this year let it set aside because we were not seeing the regrowth we wanted, and we wanted to make sure we had forage ahead of us. And it'll be interesting. I'll need to do more research to see how forage regrowth is different between those forages that did reach that full maturity and the forages that were grazed in the sweet spot. I've not observed that data for myself, but after reading that, I was like, that's definitely something I need to do going forward.
Jared, there is no data. I remember, I was lamenting to Chris Nichols one time, and because I couldn't find any data, and she said, "Because there isn't any." And I thought I was just bad at Googling, but yeah, worldwide there's no data on it. Which, and I honestly, I think that's the key. That's something that we're missing, and I think what happens is we give our pastures a bye. We accept, okay, well, this is all they can do. Whereas we certainly would, anyone who's producing grain, they should certainly wouldn't do that on their grain land. Say, if they have poor production. But a lot of times I think what I see happening is that we use our neighbors and what our neighbors doing as our metric of success. So as long as we're doing better than our neighbor, even if we're doing twice what our neighbor is doing in terms of grazing, we are doing a great job. And I don't know if you got to this part about if you have bugger all and you double bugger all, what do you have? You still have bugger all. And that's what, so if you start out with Well, here's something that I do know as an example. So I heard about this great success that this ranch in Montana had following some amendments or whatever. And I thought, wow, because I'm always looking for that because I don't have much to really get a pasture to pop once it's really warmed down. And so anyways, I followed this and found out who it was, and I finally got a hold of them on the phone. And yeah, they were just thrilled by what happened, and the amazing production. And I just kept asking questions and questions and more questions because I want to hear the numbers. I want to kind of like show me the money. Well, show me the numbers. And so I finally got to the point where, okay, so they were getting harvesting about before they used this amendment, they were harvesting about, I don't know, about 400 and 450 pounds per acre. That's what they're harvesting over the course of the whole year. After the amendment, they went to 1,000 pounds that they're harvesting. So they doubled. And that sounds pretty impressive. Until you convert that to dollars and cents. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's what I do is I take that information, I put it into stock days per acre, which is something that both Holistic Management and Ranch for Profit teach, stock days per acre. And basically that's the one stock day per acre is the amount of forage that a dry 1,000 pound dry pregnant cow would eat in a day. And it's if you're working with hay, it's the equivalent of about 24 pounds of dry matter. So when you convert that into a second, I'm going to grab my calculator here. When you convert that into stock days per acre, so we have so we have 400 and 450 pounds. Divide that by 24 pounds of dry matter for one stock day. You get, well, let's just, it's 18.75, but let's call it 19 stock days per acre. Okay, so that's what they were harvesting. Okay. Now they went to 1,000 pounds. So 1,000 pounds divided by 24 pounds of dry matter for one stock day. So they went to, well, let's call that 42, round that up a little bit to 42 stock days per acre. So that's what they were harvesting. Okay. Now, what I like to do from that point is I like to turn that into cash because I can wrap my head around that. So what I do is I use the custom grazing rates for that area. Okay. So let's go for your area. So what would a on a per day basis, what is a custom grazing rate for a cow-calf pair?
For a cow calf pair, I'm not sure. I can tell you we custom graze dairy heifers that are 1,000 pound dairy heifers, so roughly an animal unit, and we
Yeah,
get
okay.
220 per day for them.
Are you serious?
We do.
Holy
I know
crap,
people
I gotta
getting
move there.
$2.60 or more a day too, but if you compare it to what they're paying in a feedlot, it's cheap.
No, you're absolutely right. Just most people don't figure that
Well,
out.
you can use
Holy
what number you know.
moly.
You can use what
Okay,
number you know.
no, we're going to do this.
Okay.
So 220 a day. So, and you said they're 1,000 pounds. Okay, so basically that is one stock day, or one
And
standard
to
animal.
confirm,
Sorry, one.
that's custom grazing with management, not just rent. Like we're managed. Okay. Good.
Yep, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Okay. And so that dairy heifer is a standard animal unit. She's a 1,000 pound dry pregnant.
Correct. Female.
Okay. Okay. She might be a little bit better, but let's, because she's gaining weight and blah, blah, blah. But let's just, for simplicity. Okay. So that 19 stock days per acre times 220 is 40. Well, let's round it up to $42 per acre. Okay. in this scenario, that's what they're making. And then on the other scenario, so it'd be 42 stock days per acre times 220. So they're making, in that scenario, they went up, if they were grazing dairy heifers, they would be making $92 per acre.
Mm-hmm.
That's your gross.
Yeah.
And you haven't taken off land rent or mortgage payment. You haven't done anything. That's mm-hmm. your total. That's where the rubber meets the pavement, in my mind.
Yeah.
Can you raise your family?
Yeah.
On that, you know, on that mm-hmm. revenue per acre.
Yeah.
You know, at one of our EL meetings, the guy that you, Kit Farrell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm no terrible problem. With names. Kit was there. He was our speaker for that one session. And sure. one thing that he said that was really hit home for me was there is no such thing as sustainability until you are financially sustainable.
Yeah, I agree.
And boy, that stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing you can't pay your bills. But a big thing is about sustainability is your kids aren't going to come back.
Yeah.
Like if they see, all they see is hard work and poverty, mm-hmm. You know, they can't go on a vacation because there's not enough money. There's not enough time. They're not coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. No. And we see it all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
No.
So did that little scenario make sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, when you convert it to dollars, that's the exciting part. I mean, forage production doesn't mean a whole lot until you know what it means in terms of what you're making. Yeah. And when you're
talking. Right.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm talking about. Our pastures get a buy.
Yeah.
Our pastures get a buy. Mm-hmm. So now if you were, and this is something that I've done numerous times, I have taken the pastures up to 175, well, 200 plus stock days per acre.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think, I better be careful on this, but, you know, cause I'm just talking from the environments that I've been in.
Yeah.
But there's a tipping point that is around 175 stock days per acre where the system becomes self-propagating. And what I mean by that, without putting any inputs in, just your management, hence, you know, grazing mm-hmm. in the sweet spot, the system, there's enough volume there. There's enough volume in the sense of, I'm actually referring to what's in the soil, mm-hmm. you know, the soil biology and the enough, there's enough biomass that the system will start growing more forage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in no time at all, once you hit that tipping point, you can be at 325.
Wow.
So I'm just going to, let's use your same scenario. This was like when you told me 220, I just like, oh my gosh. And I was just so excited. So let's just do this.
Numbers. Yeah. Let's walk through it. And then I get a comment on it.
Okay. So we're going to go, we'll do two things. We'll do 175 stock days per acre. Cause that's, like I said, that's in my experience, that's the tipping point.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Once somehow you have to get there. Whatever it takes, fertilizer, bale grazing, whatever you need to do, you have to get to 175 stock days per acre because the system will not tip.
Mm-hmm.
It will not take off. You'll be stuck at, you'll be stuck at
wherever you are.
100, yeah. 90, like lots of places I go to, they're getting 97 stock days per acre and mm-hmm. they have been there for years.
Yeah.
Somehow you have to hit that tipping point. So mm-hmm. we'll use 175. Stock days per acre and 325 stock days per acre. And we are going to use your custom grazing dairy heifers at 220. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's go 175 times 220. Are you doing the calculation or am I
yeah,
doing
yeah.
The...
Sorry, 100. I was, but I thought you were as well, so I didn't say anything.
I am too. Well, because I need to check your math, so I'm doing
sure.
it too.
You were at, now I deleted. What were we at?
Okay, 175 stock days per acre.
Yes,
times
$220 and $385.
Is that $385?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, now 325 stock days per acre times 220, 750.
Yeah.
Do you see why I got so excited when you said 220?
Yeah. Well, I get excited when I hear you say that stuff too. And that's where like that, it, I never want to be the person who says that can't be done here and stuff, but those kinds of stock days are intense. And if you're able to do that, where exactly? You're west of me and north. So you have a shorter growing season and less rainfall, I think. I should be able to do it.
We have a shorter grazing season, but you have to be careful with that because we have more daylight hours in a day.
Okay, sure.
And that's a huge difference. So then, okay, before we do this, I just want to go back to this, leave this point. Okay, that sounds ridiculous, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I don't know how many times I have had pastures that were at 325 that I harvested in 1 year.
You don't know how many in like not many or like a lot?
No, lots.
Okay, just to confirm. Yeah.
The most I've ever done was 525.
Mm-hmm.
However, at that time I was doing what Andre Racine had talked about, was scraping the pastures.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wasn't leaving enough.
Okay.
So I don't, you know, I would never do that again.
Sure.
That 325, that's, you're still leaving lots of ground cover,
yeah.
You know, residual and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But this right here, I know it sounds unbelievable, but that's what I'm talking about. We give our pastures a buy because we have never seen it. So then we think it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So then we don't spend 2 to 3 years that it takes to learn how to graze in the sweet spot.
Yeah. So, and I think one of the biggest challenges for what I'm seeing anyway, what we're talking about with my dad is like those numbers, hands down, I could rent all the land in the neighborhood, you know, scale indefinitely. But because we don't think it's possible, either you don't do the work or what a lot of people in my area will do is we'll just plant corn. We'll just plant corn and soybeans, or we'll just, we'll do something different because it's not going to happen. But those are the kind of numbers that, that enterprise would blow everything out of the water here. And that would be incredible if we can realize that. And if we in truth can realize that. So we have,
that's why, like when you told me you're getting 220, I just like, well, you heard how excited I was.
Yeah. What's your area?
We're not even at a dollar.
Seriously?
Seriously.
It's a custom graze and animal unit, 1,000 pounds of animal.
Yeah.
That's
like,
I don't know how you even, I don't know how folks make a living on that.
Well, you can't.
Yeah.
Like if you're like, and that's, you know, that was a struggle that I had, that I didn't realize, okay, Tom, I have to get to this 175, whatever I need to do. But I was scared of fertilizer.
Yeah.
You know, I had this mental block. Mm-hmm. You haven't got to that section yet that I talk about using ammonium sulfate.
Yeah.
That was a huge mental block. I never even told I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy named Steve Kenyon.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, Steve and we have been on the same journey. You know, I think he started 2 years before me, but we have been doing the same journey. I never even told him that I used ammonium sulfate because I was so embarrassed.
Well, he might listen to this. Who knows? We'll see.
No. Oh, no, he knows already. He knows.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, he knows already. But yeah, I kept my mouth shut because I knew I was not getting the results that I needed to get, you know, to make the money that I needed to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what, I don't know. We look at cropping as an option in our area because it's so prevalent and so popular and so simple. And I want to make grazing work, but it's really hard in my area on $250 to $350 an acre land rent. Like we said that.
Holy crap!
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why we have to make it work. That's why 90 cents doesn't work here or whatever. Like we need,
No.
we, but based on those 175 animal units, we're at 385 an acre, and on $350 an acre land rent, that doesn't leave a whole lot of margin. But if we can get to 250 animal units an acre, or 325, or whatever, you know, that number is, that's where it starts to really make sense. And I want to get there, but it's one, it's hard to believe you can when you've never seen it done, like you said exactly. And two, it's awfully expensive to get there when you're paying that kind of rent year after year and kind of losing money for a few years. It's an investment to get there and
You bet.
hopes that you actually will. So it's stressful. But yeah, we're in, definitely in a high cost environment for everything. So
Well, yeah, you know what? It's hard to believe. And when you don't believe something, it's easier to just say, oh, you know, that guy's full of crap. And, you know, or yeah, it won't work. It's easy to, you know, to just dismiss it rather than ask about it. Okay, I'll give you another example of this sort of thing. So I have consistently got lambs to 115 to 125 pounds in 4.5 months consistently doing this type of grazing. Maybe not the triplets, but still the triplets are, you know, you're 90 pounds in that period of time, but definitely the singles and the twins in that 115 to 125 pounds. Any sheep producer that I have told that to, they get a glaze over their eyes, and not a single one has asked me, well, how do you do it? They just get a glaze over their eyes, and he's full of it.
Okay, so I do, we're already close to an hour and a half here, but a kind of question on this grazing the sweet spot stuff, that the in practice, the kind of last question here I've got for you. How do you, so it sounds great. The challenge is when you have hundreds or thousands of acres all growing at once, how do you manage to keep all the forage within the sweet spot?
Yes. Here's the only way that I have been able to find out how to do it, or to do it successfully. You have to have more than one herd. Maybe there's somebody who can do it, but I have not been able to do it with one herd. I've had to have, you know, at least two herds, and because it's clip and go. So all you need is that you just need a little bit of bite, just a little bit of, you know, sometimes you have, well, when I was out visiting Jonathan, out there in Virginia, you know, I said, okay, let's get down on our knees and look. And you could see all these plants having a little bite from, you know, undesirable plants, what we consider undesirable plants. When you got down there, his steers had been taking little bites off of all this stuff. It was a smorgasbord, and they were just clip and go, clip and go. And that's all you need. So then when you have you know, a cow calf operation, let's do that. Okay. So you split up your herd, okay, and into two groups, and you get moving. And so now you're covering all this area. You don't have to have a big mob to tramp down a lot of plants. You just have to take that bite. But the cool thing, the added thing is once you have your animals trained to act as a herd, they do that. They will move through that paddock as a herd. So then you get the trampling effect. You get that density without any labor, because they go and move as a herd. And the Gateway Research Organization, ran their pasture for one season, and they did this mob grazing paddock. So then I was moving, I think I was moving every 4 hours in that paddock. When the gal took the drone and she took pictures with the drone of the two paddocks side by side, there was visually no difference between the herd effect of the amount of trampling, because those heifers, those breeding heifers, well, they all moved themselves. Like they're all buddies. So they all went to water together. They they grazed together. So you get that herd effect.
Yeah.
So so we start with two groups, and then in the latitude that I've grazed, and this has to do with sunlight, Jared, by August 7th, I want to have stockpiled anything that I have planned on stockpiling. It starts stockpiling by August 7th because we don't have enough daylight hours to grow enough forage to make it worthwhile, you know, to have enough volume to go into the winter. So at that time is when I combine the herds. So I was able to get all this stuff clipped. And to keep it vegetative, keep it, you know, keep the roots pulsing. And now I can combine the herds and that all that other, that those other paddocks stockpile.
I'm curious, when you were able to figure that out, what kind of gains from that 1.5 to 1.7 were you, what kind of gains were you getting after you really figured out that grazing?
2.5 on heifers.
Wow.
And crappy heifers.
Wow. Well, that's incredible. So
phenomenal. And, well, Jared, like a, you know, those hogs, you know, getting that kind of gain on the lambs, you know, in 4.5 months. And it's been consistent. You know, I've been as ranch manager now, I've been, I think, three places. And then I've done some stuff for, you know, a couple different, just manage the grass. And I get that. And it's keeping it in the sweet spot. I know you haven't watched the one video yet, but there's a video on my YouTube channel. It's, I call out 300 finishing heifers out of a bush. What the video is to show I did it with a whistle. And the reason, you know, it's just to make my life simple. And so I trained those to a whistle because I knew we're going to be in some bush paddocks and it's hard to get them out. So basically what the video is, it's 5 minutes. I called 300 heifers out into another paddock. So when I was at the Ranch of Profit School there in Oklahoma, a guy from Florida was asking me about, well, how do you do that? And so then I showed him the video and he said, he actually wasn't paying much attention to what I was doing with the whistle. He was looking at all the grass. And he said, that's what the grass that you have there? I said, yeah. And then it dawned on me, that video was taken in August of 2021. And in Athabasca County. In 2021, Athabasca County was declared agricultural disaster because of drought and heat. And just pay attention to that when you check out that video. And I didn't do anything amazing. Like, I'm not a rocket scientist. All I did was I followed two principles. I followed the recovery period and the rest period. All I did was I followed those two. And I just, you know, we had a great spring. I think I actually talked about that in the book. So we started that spring. We started, it was a fantastic spring. So in at that area, at that latitude, 35 days plus or minus 5 days is the recovery period. Okay. And the graze period is 3 days. And I detail in the book how I came up with that 3 days. And you're past that.
I've read that part. That was, No, that's really good. And I'm going to have to reread it again after this. And you got my mind thinking, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then what I did was once we hit those, you know, the tap went off at beginning of June. And then mid-June, we hit record-setting temperatures, you know, in the 40s. Celsius. I don't know what that is. And Fahrenheit. But all I did was I just adjusted. You know, this, I actually thought that the grass had stopped growing. It didn't. It just slowed right down. So then my graze period went to, my graze period, I can't remember, it was 5 or 6 days. think it was 5 days my grace period went to. And that's all I did for that 6 week period. I just slowed down. And then once the temperature dropped and then we got a shot of rain, all that forage was ready to pop. And the amount of growth that we got at that period of time, I've never seen it in 23 years of grazing. I have never seen that type of growth, second half of August into September.
Yeah.
But the grass was sitting there waiting because it was still vegetative.
Yeah.
It was just growing slowly. And then it was like, poof, it got the conditions and it just,
We saw the same thing. Yeah. It was like spring. Oh, you did, in August and September. It was pretty cool.
Okay. There. Yeah. And we get scared of drought. Because it is a scary thing. I remember my first year, 3 years of grazing, we were in drought. We got 7 to 9 inches each year. And I remember scrambling. I was grazing ditches. I was grazing road allowances because I knew my recovery period was longer than what I had anticipated. And it's not fun.
Yeah.
But if I didn't, if I didn't get out early, in a dry spring and get the grass just clipped, not taken down, I'm just talking that little bite.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't do that, I know what the results would be. I would lose, if we did get rain, the grass has already done its job for the year, because it would have ended up going into a reproductive phase.
Yeah.
And I would have lost a ton of production. So got to get out early. We got to get and just get it clipped and clip and go and not take it down. When I'm grazing, when you're going this fast, a lot of times maybe 30% of the forage that you're capturing at that time. And it's just to keep it vegetated because the big money, for cow calf producer is the fall and winter grazing when you can cut down your feed costs.
I'm just thinking on that. You've got me thinking on our place and what we can do here. So it's exciting.
Jared, you have to remember, in my experience of renting a lot of land and then, going to these other places, it takes 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it takes 2 to 3 years to learn, but that coincides with the 2 to 3 years it takes to wake up the biology.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, I guess we'll start with last of my two questions here is, if people want to buy this book, and they should, where should they go to find it? Is this available anywhere? Do you have a website? Find out more about you, or if there's any other things you want to plug, go ahead and throw that out now.
They can go to my website. If they just Google ranching like a 12-year-old, it'll take you there. It's kind of like the cow-calf producer who you can either take it to your calf to the sale barn right off the cow. And that for me, that's Amazon.
Sure.
Or, I can hold that calf over and do a few things with it. And that's my webpage. I make $15 off of Amazon when a book is sold off Amazon. Yeah. And I make $32 when it's off my webpage.
Cool. Good. So go to the website. Yeah.
Yeah. Go to the website.
Nothing wrong. Let's plug that. Let's go to the website. Last question I like to ask everybody is, what's 1, 2, 3, 4, something like that, resources that were important to you in your career that you would recommend people check out? And you've mentioned a few throughout this here already, but if there's, you want to repeat those, or if there's any others that you would want to recommend, I'd love to hear those.
You bet. I did take holistic management. I think it's changed. Well, I know it's changed quite a bit since I took it. It used to be a full week-long course.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say enough good things about Ranch for Profit and really the EO program. Andre Vosine's book, Grass Productivity, huge for me. And something that helped me out a lot was Jim Gerrish's book, Management Intensive Grazing. He explains so well the importance of getting out early. And it's nerve wracking. I'm still, after doing this, all these years, it's still nerve wracking to me. And I have made, in that time, I have made three mistakes, where I got out too early. But you just follow his protocol. Okay. You were feeding before. Once you realize, okay, I got up too early, just go back to feeding. Like, no big deal.
That's a good point right there, because the fear of getting going too early, and it's like, what's the worst that happens? You feed like you would have if you didn't go out.
Exactly. And then once you have the animal handling is huge, because it's a system. I talk about that. I think I have an article coming out in the Stock and Grass Farmer talking about the importance of learning how to do the wave, and that's moving little animals, that, like the newborns. I don't know how many people I talk to, they've moved to calving on grass. Well, they're calving right at the time that the grass needs to be clipped. And when I talk about this, oh, this rule comes up, you cannot move those newborn animals. And that's simply not true. And so I did the video. I call it the wave. The reason I call it the wave is because it's creating a little ripple, and it reminds me of a pond. And I know this is not how Bud Williams taught doing this sort of thing. But I'm a, been a huge follower of his, since 2000. And okay, I tweaked it, and I find it works exceptionally well. And in the video, you'll see me, I move about 325 young pairs. The calves, some of them are, just a few days old. And I moved them all by myself out through a gate, and then I ended up having to go around a swamp. So I had to go out on the road into another paddock. And I did that all by myself on horseback. And
Oh, go ahead.
go ahead.
I was just going to say, you should share where people can find your videos too, if that's something you want to plug, or maybe help
Ranching
me through the book.
on YouTube, ranching like a 12-year-old.
Perfect.
And that'll take you right there. I was going to say one other thing. Oh, grazing chart. People do not use a grazing chart. And people who have the same schooling as I do, I found this out going to ranches to manage ranches. People do not use the grazing chart. And if they do, they certainly don't. They use it as a record and not as a planning tool like it should be used. I had this mob. It's actually a picture on the cover of the book, with the what there's about 200 head of various classes of cattle in there. And then there was, like, altogether, I guess, about 500 sheep. And then I think about 60 or 70 hogs, and then 20 horses in there. So it's just moving, doing a tour. And I see this one paddock, and it was that Kentucky bluegrass and creeping red fescue. That's kind of, some red, a little bit of white clover. And it had been a sheep pasture for 15 years under irrigation. And that's what was new. And it's just like, oh, there's hardly any grass here. And I kind of was thinking that it should be in the rotation. So anyways, I go back to my grazing chart, and I realized, oh, we're already at 42 days of recovery. We need to get this grass clipped, because it's not going to grow anymore. It's going to be going into reproductive phase right away. So I moved the mob in there. I can't remember if it was a full day or three quarters of a day, but let's say just for a day, I moved the mob in there. And then I moved them out the next day. And about a week later, I'm riding around, and I see this, all this green in the distance. And and I did that for 2 days, and I thought, okay, I got to go over there. It was that paddock. There had to be, yeah, the grass was minimum 12 inches high, 12 to 16 inches high. And the variety of the diversity of forage in there was phenomenal. It was just like, how did this happen? I had grown great grass in the past, but it was nothing like what had happened, in a matter of a week. And I believe it was because the mob, all these different, the diversity in the mob, and all these animals, they massage the soil. Each one massages the soil differently. And when you have them acting all together, you get all that stimulus all together.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same way when you're doing a polyculture, the amazing things that happens, but you don't get those same amazing things happen if you are doing like leader follower, you know, if you're doing a grain system where, you know, one year you plant this and the next year on that you plant, you know, crop rotation, you don't get that benefit until you put them all together. And that's what I have seen using a leader follower with animals. Mm-hmm. You do not get the same results as you do when you put them all together.
I know
that's a little off topic, but that was right, my plug for using the grazing chart.
Well, that's a tool I want to figure out too. When I was at the Ranching for Profit school, it was the first time I looked at it. They explained it and I was like, that actually makes sense. Otherwise, every time before that, I was like, I'm never going to use that. That's ridiculous. Look at that thing. How am I going to use that? But what they explained it really well. And I think there's a ton of value to it. We just got to start utilizing it. But
And I think, you know what? I think we get arrogant and think that we can use our grazier's eye. And I'll give you a quick example. There's this plant I've never experienced before called Lepidasia or something like that.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that?
Okay. I think I've heard of people talk about it. I don't think we have it in our area, but yeah.
Okay. Well, and when I went to Jonathan's there at in Virginia, so he has that. And there was one place that he had a lot of it. And as we're walking through his different pastures, there's some that the steers had bitten and clipped. And then we went to another place where they didn't touch any of it. And in that grazing cell, started looking at the cowpats. And there was lots of cowpats that were like that 4-inch high.
Sure.
And what that told me was that he just went, you know, and then he told me what his recovery period was. And there you go. And he just went a little bit long. And now that this plant that was the cattle liked crossed the line, and they're not going to, you know, they aren't interested in it because I'm sure that the quality has gone down. So it's not, you know, there's a lot of other things that they could eat.
Cool. Let's see. Well, I really appreciate you joining me today, Tom. I have looked forward to this. I know when you reached out to me, we talked a long time ago, and I wanted to read the book and see what I thought and if it was aligned with this kind of mindset of the herd quitter philosophy in the podcast. And it absolutely does. It's really valuable, and I hope people go out and buy it. I appreciate you putting it together. I know that was not, or I have no doubt that was not an easy process, but it was it's awesome. So thank
you. Well, I thank you for having me. I really appreciate this, Jared. Had I known that you're such a slow reader, I would have sent the book to you 2 years ago.
Yeah, that would have been perfect. Yeah. Well, we'll pick it up in 2 years when I finish it. We'll do another one. How's that sound?
Sounds good. Sounds great.
Cool. All right. Thanks so much, Tom.
Ciao, ciao.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.